You ready?
Showtime.
On May 3rd, summer starts with the Fall Guy.
Let's do it later.
Let's drink a spicy margarita.
Make some bad decisions.
Yes.
Audiences are falling in love with the most entertaining film of the year.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy?
Fall Guy.
That's what the poster said.
See Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt in the movie critics say exists to make you happy.
Trying to make it out?
Nope.
Because I don't either. It's not what I'm into right now.
What are you into?
Talking.
Yeah.
The Fall Guy. Only in theaters May 3rd. Rated PG-13.
Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th, hosted by Kevin Hart. The seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady, live only on Netflix.
Hello and welcome to the Big Strong Leicester Boys podcast, where we record this one about, well, probably less than an hour after the full-time Wizards just gone at Old Trafford, Leicester losing by 3-0, still trying to kind of make out exactly how I feel about that performance. But obviously goes without saying, very disappointed with the result itself. We'll get the thoughts on that game from the lads in a couple of moments' time. We've got Rick, we've got Jordan, and we've got Jack as well. And also, I need to let you know about some guests which are joining us a little bit later on today here on the podcast. So during the week, you may or may not have seen it marked 20 years since the football club was saved from administration by a group of businessmen. Gary Lineker was very much involved with that, as was a certain John Holmes, the father of Jack. And he's going to join us a little bit later on, along with James Johnson, who's also part of that team of people which helped save the club all them years ago. So that should be a really interesting one for you. We'll do that in about 20 minutes time. But before then, let's talk about the game then, shall we? And as has come to be the usual way into this podcast, we'll start with Jack, because I want to get your thoughts on your dad coming on very shortly, which is should be really, really interesting. I'm genuinely really interested about that one. But your thoughts on the game, first and foremost, 3-0. It only happened about, 40 minutes ago now. So it's all a little bit raw still, isn't it?
It's still a bit raw. Well, it was disappointing. I think having reflected on it a little bit, I've stopped throwing my toys out of my pram. It's a game. I know we lost 3-0. I know we got battered in the second half. But it's one of those that we should at least get a point from or something from the game. I thought we played really well in the first half and we looked really bright. But second half, we were just not at it, and our defense was as chaotic as my dad's entrance into the podcast. It's just really disappointing. We're losing too many games and we concede too many goals. We still look bright going forward, but it's the story of our season, really. So yeah, just a really, really frustrating one again. I thought Manu were good, but I thought the ref was terrible, which I'm sure we'll talk about, but It's really frustrating.
Yeah, I should probably mention the start of the podcast with that music as well. Video killed the radio star, of course, alluding to a couple of VAR decisions which absolutely went against Leicester today, and no escaping whether you think they were the right ones or wrong ones, has massively had an influence on the outcome of the game. The tackle or the challenge from Sabitzer on Wout Fez, they had a look at it and deemed it wasn't a red card offence. I mean, it's incredibly high. I think the only thing is that maybe there wasn't that much contact. I mean, if you see some freeze frames, it looks bad, but maybe in real time, they just don't think there was enough contact there. But that all being said, I think Leicester can absolutely have an argument to say that should have been a red card. And then, of course, the second goal, Marcus Rashford racing through, Castagne puts his arm up. I think we all did the same thing. We all kind of maybe sat back and thought, hey, you know, he's offside. And we then went through the usual VAR process and still looked offside. And then lo and behold, what we didn't see was Wout on the other side of the pitch, just about playing him on. And, you know, when we were done so harshly, or Harvey was done so harshly last week against Spurs, with that offside decision, which obviously, you know, didn't have a bearing on the game because Leicester had won it. But today it did, Jordan, you know, and up until that point, Leicester were massively in it. And it just felt that everyone's heads just completely went after that second goal. I mean, it's unprofessional and, you know, it shouldn't have happened. But after that second goal, Leicester just looked a completely different team, didn't they?
Yeah. And I know we've been chatting in the WhatsApp group during the game. I decided to play Sunday morning football today, which was a good decision because we had 10 men and I got the winner towards the end. I thought I'd drop that in. Feel a bit like Ric Flair because I'm drinking a Peretti as well. So I might be a little bit better crack today because I've had a few beers. But for me, the game just hinged on two terrible officiating decisions. The first one, Sabitzer, I mean, you're saying that the referee didn't see that. Well, he's 5 yards away.
You know, he saw it for sure, yeah.
So it's more palatable before VAR if the referee misses that and you could moan about it. But when there's VAR, these officials have got absolutely no excuse. And, you know, these officials have clearly never played the game at any level. Either that or they're either corrupt or inept, one of the two, if not both, which might be a bit harsh. But how anybody on a neutral persuasion can watch that and say that's not a red card is absolutely baffling. You know, you're saying it went to VAR. It's knee high, six studs in the leg. And yeah. let's not kid ourselves. If that was Wout Fez, he'd be halfway down the M6 by half time. It's at Old Trafford. That's the only reason that they've not given a red card. And 2 minutes later, Fez gets booked for a tackle that's nowhere near as bad. And in the second half, Mendy gets booked. It's not even a foul.
No, it's not.
The Mendy not. Challenge.
Yeah.
So, right, we're going at half-time 1-0 down. We were the better side for half an hour. Barnes probably should have scored. De Gea made a wonderful save at the back post. We might come on to the keeper, but that's what a world-class keeper does, keeps you in the game. We're in the game at half-time. Now, the second goal, as a player, as a right-back, I know like people are saying, Castagne, he's a bit lazy. He's got his arm in the air. It's offside. The geezer, the lino is 20 yards away, looking across the line. His flag's up. He can see it with the naked eye. But you've got some bloke 300 miles away in Uxbridge pissing about on an Etch-a-Sketch, drawing lines about on the pitch. And the Barnes one last week was no different. It was no different. They're making it up. They are making it up as they go along. The lino's got his flag up and they are going to VAR thinking, how can we get a goal here for Man United? In what way can we make it look like Rashford's onside? Because he's not. He's the wrong side of Castagne. And they draw a line on Fez's shoulder and on Rashford's boot. It's not even level. Mm. Now, no. I admit after that goal, we were rubbish, right? Yeah. But until that goal goes in, we were the better team and we were well in the game. And sometimes you as a player, you just think, fuck it, we ain't getting anything here. And that, to me, is what happened. Dust yourself down and go again next week. Just get out of there. That's what it looked like to me. And I, like I say, I just think the game hinged on two officiating decisions that we would never, ever have got the other way around.
Mm, there's so much to go at here, Rick. And, mate, I'm sorry, I haven't got any music. I just realised for today's episode. Sorry about that, Val. That's right, isn't it? They don't deserve the music today. But look, on that first half performance, the first 5 minutes, Man United came flying out the traps. And then for about 15, 20, it was all Leicester. You know, and we had six or seven attempts. And then Vout makes that mistake and United score. And I just never really then think we carried that same threat. But ultimately overall on the balance of play, particularly in the first hour, probably we had as many chances as them, and you know, we didn't take ours and they took theirs. I mean, you know, you can complain about the decisions, and I think, you know, Jordan's right, you know, we have absolutely every right to, but at the same time we need to look at ourselves as well and say, look, you know, we should have scored two goals in that first half, and again, if we did, the game's completely different, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely everything you say. The way I feel right now, and it's, I was a bit worried about coming straight on here after a defeat, because I'm not a man who takes defeat for Leicester well. I'm usually very negative. I feel like I've been egged, which, as a man, I feel like when someone lobs an egg at you, it's one of the most humiliating things. I'd rather.
Whatever happened to egging? Like, no one goes out egging anymore.
Well, you say that, mate. About 8 years ago, I was coming out the tube station at Parsons Green, right?
Yeah.
and I've been egged out of nowhere. You've full hammered me in the face, right? And that feels like what it's been like today. And what do you do? Because you're egged, you want to go wild, but you can't. I was just there, like, literally shaking my hand. That's how I feel like today, because first 30 minutes, unbelievable, weren't we?
We were.
To a man, we were unbelievable. But, yeah, we should have probably finished at least one of those chances. But I don't know. We're still vulnerable at the back. Our heads went down. There was a little bit of negative body language amongst a few of them as well afterwards, which is understandable. You know, the last two results have probably masked over a season of some you know, issues that we need to iron out. And I think we're going to have bumps in the road. So, yeah. As Jordan says, we've got to dust ourselves down now because we've got a massive 2 weeks. Arsenal, we're going to be revved up next week. And then we've got Blackburn in the cup. We can't afford to let our season get in jeopardy because of today.
Mm. Before we move on, I think we've all got questions about the egging, Rick. how long ago was this?
I've been back living in Leicestershire from London since 2014. So we're talking 10 years ago.
Right.
And it was actually Valentine's Day, because I remember.
What were you doing in Parsons Green? That's not an area I would...
Well, I used to live that way, but I didn't... Not during this period, so you can't...
Yeah,
so I lived in Wimbledon, and it was one of those where signal failure, I had to get out at Parsons Green and go and look for a bus or walk home. And honestly, out of nowhere, from the Waitrose, someone has launched an egg at me. And it just hit me on the head. I'm obviously wearing glasses. There's egg coming down my glasses. And I'm fuming. But I've got no... Who can you be angry at? I'm literally turning around looking. And it's like that today with VAR or just Man United being spawny. And us being crap. But, yeah. So...
It's a hotbed of egging around there.
It is, mate. And I've been brought up on egging. You know, you weren't trick-or-treating at Halloween. You know, good, honest egging. That's what you got things done. But, yeah. You don't expect it down in Parsons Green, do you? But you can never be too sure.
Was this not good, honest egging?
Well, it was, but come on. It's a low blow. I didn't even see who egged me. I would have shook his hand or hit or her if she did it. But, you know, it was out of nowhere. Got me, blindsided me.
I remember once, Rick, Valentine's Day, Halloween. My mate moved out of the house around the corner. Yeah. I've had a few horrors on Valentine's Day. Yeah, my mate moved out of this house and we were playing football and one of the lads kicked it against his garage. The new bloke bowls out the house thinking, you know, I'll give these lads what for. You know, that ball, it's my garage again. I'll stick a knife in it. Bad move, mate. It's Halloween next week. You're going to get egged to foot.
Exactly.
Oh, dear me, dear me. Jack, just because I can see your dad now taking his seat once again for the next part of this podcast, before we do speak to your dad, John Holmes, the former chairman of Leicester City, how are you feeling about him coming on?
Slightly nervous. Particularly now after we've just spoken about egging for 5 minutes. Which
I don't think you heard that bit.
Not related. Can you hear us, Dad? You're on mute. We can get you off now.
I've muted him.
You can take you off mute.
There we are.
You're off mute. Can you hear us?
I can.
Oh, excellent. Good. How are you?
Marvellous.
Good. You looking after my dog?
Wretched thing. Yes, just been given a little bollocking.
So, yeah, I mean, we might as well do this now then, shall we? So,
where is James?
James will
appear. We're still waiting for James.
Yeah, I'll message him.
Well, no rush. So look, we are now joined by the former chairman of Leicester City, John Holmes, also the father of Jack. So, John, before we get stuck into the chat about your time, you know, at the football club, how are you feeling about coming on this podcast today? I mean, first and foremost, I mean, thank you for joining us. Really appreciate it.
I'm terrified, of course.
What could you possibly be scared about?
Well, I mean, who knows what Jack might say to embarrass his father, or what I might say to embarrass him, more likely.
Speaking of embarrassing, here's James.
I thought you'd say that, Jack.
I was loud, Christ.
Yeah. Are we marginally disappointed at the moment?
I think so. Yeah. I mean, probably more so than marginally. James, we are live and recording, by the way. Welcome to the podcast. This is like how we like to do things. off the cuff. So look, we've got John Holmes and James Johnson now with us here on the podcast. So as we mentioned at the start of it, it's now 20 years since the club came out of administration, and John and James were huge parts of that, along with Gary Lineker all them years ago. And yeah, I know we've got loads of questions about that. I mean, the first one, really an obvious one for me, John, to go to you first, was how on earth did you come about to be a part of that group? And what was that like at the time? It must have been incredibly surreal.
Well, it was clear early in that season that the club were in some kind of a mess, in that I got a proposal early in the season. Oh, they were short of money. Would I consider some loan stock and so on and so on? And to be honest, given the people who were running the club at that point, I wasn't absolutely very keen on that. Mistakes have been made earlier. The decision to go public was pretty disastrous. And a lot of nonsense was talked at that time. And I think the finances got out of control. Then they had this sort of triple whammy. They lost Martin O'Neill, which at some point was going to be inevitable. Their recruitment process for a new manager was a bit disastrous. They ended up with Peter Taylor, who was never going to work, to be honest, despite the fact they started fairly well and astonishingly went to the top of the league, first time for ages and ages. Yeah. But I'd come across Taylor before. He was no kind of a manager. He was, you know, he was a sort of part-time Norman Wisdom impersonator. And his ability to sign players, being as they got quite a bit of money for Heskey, they sort of frittered that away. Two players who were technically blind, and several others who had no idea how to play. Added to that, they moved into the new stadium. The board were all squabbling with each other most of the time, and ITV Digital collapsed. So it was pretty inevitable a few weeks later when they said they'd gone into administration. And at that point, Greg Clark approached me and he said he had this plan to put together a group of local shareholders, nobody having a great majority. Shareholdings you would need to put in between 100 and 250,000. We were going to raise 5 million. And would Gary be the sort of icon to lead this on? And Gary and I had a chat, and he said, yeah, but I can't do any work. You'll have to do the work. I went back to Greg and told him that would be the case. He was happy enough with that. The other Greg Dyke, gave Gary permission to do it. At that point, he was director general of the BBC. And we set about raising money and recruiting people. And then James came along, which was a massive bonus, because James said, I will do the legal work for nothing. And he worked for one of the Magic Circle firms in the city. So that was a big bonus. I confess, my hope all the way along was that Mr. Big would emerge from somewhere and say, no, I'm going to put in a bid and take the whole lot, because I wasn't quite sure that we were ever going to raise enough money the other way. There were one or two people who technically could have done that. David Ross was one, who'd made money out of the Carphone warehouse sale. He had a house in the county at Neville Holt. He was from Grimsby originally. I knew him quite well. He was quite friendly. We were quite friendly, but he wasn't that committed to football or to the idea, to be honest. David Wilson Holmes was the other. And he wouldn't answer the phone to us. He wouldn't even answer the phone to Gary. So we gave that one up fairly quickly. So we set about collecting, you know, dribs and drabs of money. Some people put in decent amounts. And we got to about 1 million or so short of that. one of the great moments of that, and one of the best things was getting the call from Emil Heskey to say that he would put the money in, which I thought was a fantastic gesture from a really nice lad who was a Leicester boy, wasn't a Leicester supporter, never was, unfortunately, victim of the television age. He was a Liverpool supporter. But anyway, the fact that he was prepared to put money in was great. We had one or two others who put money in, and we got to 4 million. And Greg said, we can just about do that. I'll talk to the administrator. We'd been plagued all the time by the prospect of one or two of the former directors in the shape of Roy Parker and Gilbert Kinch trying to buy the club. I knew from experience of them that that would have been a total disaster. And that made me fairly keen that we got over the line. And during these discussions, I said, this is all very well, but who's going to be chairman? And Greg Clark said, well, we think you should be. Now, I'd never wanted to be a football club chairman. I'd been offered, ironically, the post of CEO a long time before that, when Trevor Bennett tried to take the club over. He failed in his takeover, which saved me the turning Trevor down. So we ended up where we were. But we were never really, to get a football club really well up and running, you have to have a harmonious team. You have to have the football side and the administration side working together, you know, to cliche, singing off the same hymn sheet. And we didn't. In retrospect, we made one or two mistakes. Although we got up, and Mickey Adams and Dave Bassett were working together then, and it did well. And then we didn't have a director of recruitment, which we should have done, but we probably couldn't afford one. Dave Bassett bought some defenders who were people who couldn't defend. And although he bought some attackers who definitely could attack, and we were unlucky to go down. Actually, we had three players up front, scored 10 goals when we did get up front. But we, in the first place, got promoted, which was excellent. And I took that as an opportunity to say, right, I'm the most successful chairman in the club's history. I've only lost one game, and that was ridiculous, losing it in the ninth minute of stoppage time when there'd only been signalled about three. So I'll jump off the side.
I thought you might mention that, Dad. You mention it quite so often. Yeah, I know, James. I haven't really spoken to you about this, James, but your role as legal, I don't actually know what your title was when you were on the board. Presumably you had a more grand title than legal person, I presume, but you got involved in some quite interesting stuff during that time.
We had all sorts of interesting stuff. So yeah, I got involved. I was a banking partner at Clifford Chance, and I wrote to Greg on a Friday, and Greg was in my office on the Tuesday and told me what was going on, and then invited him up to Leicester to meet with John and Tim Davis, who'd literally written in as an accountant as well. So we set the whole thing up. It was the fundraising. It was quite funny because, as John said, we struggled. It was just after the .com crash. People didn't have the money, so we needed, I think it was 6 million in the end, and we were struggling. And things went with the form. It was literally like one critical game in it all was Reading away. If we won, it would look like promotion was, you know, favourite there. We would probably get promoted. But if we lost, we suddenly went into the also-ran category. And the fundraising was at a very tricky level. And fortunately, we won 3-1. And actually, on the way home at Reading platform, I managed to get 25 grand off one lucky Leicester City supporter. The euphoric moment stuck his hand up. So that was it. So we're putting it together. And then, as John said, one of the funniest ones was, yeah, you had Kinch and Parker, who were supposedly putting together this rival consortium. But then I was tipped off that somebody said to me, you don't need to worry about that. Gilbert Kinch has fallen for one of these Nigerian scams. And Kinch had Kinch's coach, a very respectable Leicester company. But if you remember those scams, there were emails where, you know, the grammar was appalling, the spelling was reported, and they invited you to make some sort of investment somewhere. Well, anyway, he gave them unbelievably £2 million. So that absolutely scuppered their bid, whatever else they were thinking. So we went on, and we had some, you know, we went on and on. And then there was a very funny one, actually, 2 weeks after we were into it, in my real day job, I was invited to do a small dinner at HSBC by their restructuring group. And blow me, there was about 12 of us invited, but one of the others was Nick Dargan, the administrator, by pure chance. So we got in there and got to know him. And Nick, despite being a Man U fan, was extraordinarily helpful. And I'm sorry to say that today, obviously. But so we went on, but it wasn't all plain sailing. As John said, we ended up short. We were granted exclusivity on the day of the Millwall game. And one of the great things was that Millwall's fans had been misbehaving yet again. So if you remember, they were banned from all away grounds that season. So when the announcement was made, the whole stadium was absolutely packed full of Leicester, nobody else. And it was wonderful. It was a little unfortunate when Steve Claridge put them up one up after 5 minutes, but we won 4-1. It was a euphoric day. But unfortunately for us doing it, at that point, assumed we were there. And we weren't. And the club was still losing money. And we basically had to do a deal with Teachers, who were the mortgagee of the stadium, but effectively owned it. And we had to get their debt down and everything. But we would continue to negotiate. But the club was running out of money. And so just before Christmas, we needed, I think it was £750,000. And there's no guarantee we were going to come out. Well, Teachers stumped up 500,000. And then the five of us, so John, Gary, Greg, Tim and me, stumped up 50 each to put in. And that kept the club going over Christmas. And, you know, we were going on and on, but we still had to agree to deal with Teachers. And we basically were going to run out of cash first thing in the new year. And I remember being at work on New Year's Eve. And at 8 o'clock on New Year's Eve, I agreed the deal with Teachers to write down their debt. And at that point was safe. And I went straight up to my local, I was in London, and I got in the car, drove up to Barkby, where I come from, and met my brother and my mates in the pub to celebrate New Year's Eve and give them the good news. And it was just wonderful.
I think sure the pub James lived in a different world to the rest of us. You know, he talks about the dot-com boom. We got money from people who made pies and people who sold, you know, sold milk.
I know, but our best
wasn't very high tech.
No, John, the best one was we were the king of the hauliers, weren't we? We had all the hauliers.
Yep. We were very basic tradesmen from Leicester.
Yeah. And I will say one of the great things for me, I met so many wonderful people through it. There's a whole load there who stumped up and you got to know them. And they were really great people. Most of them absolute passionate Leicester fans. One or two weren't, one or two coming in for the ride. You know, and I just remembered. And then we had the directors, and it was, do you remember Peter Hockenhole?
Yep.
And he put in 100,000, to be fair to him. And he said, look, you know, I want to be a director. I want to be a director. And anyway, we said, no, you can't ask that. Can't. And in the end, we said, look, to get his money, you're going. But he did come up with one of the funniest lines I've ever heard when we played Chelsea away. And it was Abramovich's first home game. Now, Peter Hockenhole at the time owned 6 petrol stations in Leicestershire. And anyway, he somehow got to Abramovich in the boardroom at Chelsea. And through the interpreters, he went up to him and he said, hello, my name's Peter Hockenhole. I believe we're in the same line of business. He had 6 petrol stations in Leicestershire and Abramovich had God knows what.
Yeah, I think neither had Hockenhole got the assets of an entire region, which he raped, but that's another matter.
It was its high point. Sorry, I digress.
It's really interesting to hear this, because I remember when I was, I was similar age to Jack, grew up in the Premier League years under O'Neill. And I remember my dad used to say, you know, this is as good as it gets, as good as it gets. And then we got the new ground and I was thinking, oh, bloody hell, we're massive, we are. Yeah. And obviously we would go down and come straight back up and then went back down. But obviously after just losing to United, it's kind of a bit humbling, really. It brings me back down to earth a little bit. But I was just wondering about all these owners in the Premier League now. Obviously, you've got the Qataris looking at United. Americans just got Chelsea. Just what you think to all the swathes of money now in the Prem. And, you know, I think just purely because of the past and, you know, when you guys were there, like little old Leicester still competing and still winning trophies, how much of an achievement that really is. And obviously the ties have been absolutely fantastic for us at King Power.
Well, we were, in a sense, as I say, I was hoping that Mr. Big would come along. He didn't, clearly. Maybe because we set out, maybe because we only looked in the English market. This was Greg's plan, which we stuck to. And, you know, I thought it was a nice way to run a football club, to have it sort of locally controlled and so on. It's the way Leicester had always been. I think the sad thing was, you see, Leicester overperformed for a long period during their history. But after the war, they did do okay, really. They came back. They were controlled by several fairly shrewd businessmen. And then as time went on, the shrewd businessmen handed their businesses and their roles onto their not so shrewd offspring or a new generation. Sid Needham was second generation anyway, and he wasn't. I mean, Sid was nice bloke, but not very good, chiefly remembered for when the FA Cup draw was taken, he dropped all the balls on the floor live on the draw. Terry Shipman was not as shrewd, I don't think, as his dad. Alf Pallett had no heir. Tom Blore, again, his son wasn't interested. He was interested, went on and off, but in the end wasn't that interested. Dennis Sharp didn't have an heir who was very good. So the old family sort of, they tried to hang on to the club, bring the odd new people in, but they all had to come in on their terms. Nobody got control. Colin McLeod, who was quite shrewd, I think probably, but didn't understand football, came in, left fairly quickly. Bill Page just wanted the prestige of the whole thing, and I'd have never thought he was that clever. And Martin George came on, but Martin George didn't have the money that he has now. One of the mistakes that I made was I sacked Martin George off the board when I took over. Well, just after I took over. The reason for that was that Martin was very unpopular with the staff and had a very domineering manner. And the other board members, I felt, would never get a word in. In some cases, that would have been a decided bonus. But he didn't actually at that point have the money he had today. And about 2-3 years later, I can remember him saying to me in the boardroom, oh, you were silly to turn away. Now I've got all this money, because he inherited a lot. And then he's been very, very successful in his milling business. So he would now have the assets that could have taken us onto a different level at that point. And actually, he was not a bad chairman. His problem was that Martin had been thwarted in his own family business by his brother was very clever. His brother invented Weetabix, and actually his brother got him kicked off the family board, which was a big blow to Martin for his self-esteem and so on. So it's all about personalities and families and things that go wrong. And we didn't have the chemistry off the pitch or on the pitch together to make it go right. And of course, after a time, it broke down. We were unlucky when we got up. We didn't really have a defence. Dabby's ass was signed later on and was probably the best of the centre-backs we got. Matt Elliott and all that. Generation Taggart and Walshy had gone. So we were struggling to that degree.
John, I've got a question for you, if you don't mind. I mean, fascinating what you're saying. I could probably listen to you all day on this. But that era, another one of the reasons that we're all told about that we ended up in his administration was after the Dennis Wise debacle. And that horrendous agent Eric Hall with his monster catchphrase. Have you got any anecdotes to tell us about Eric?
Yeah, well, you've probably been tipped off about this. The first night I was chairman, I went into the boardroom, and I think it was Tony Lander, who would never take any responsibility for anything himself, but he came over and tapped me on the shoulder and said, "Have you seen who's over there?" And it was Eric Hall, who I probably knew a little bit. He's an idiot. I'd once told him to shut up on the radio, on Radio 5 before when he was talking nonsense. So I went over and said, "Eric, I'm sorry, but you're barred. Now, please go away. You're not allowed in this room," and so on. And he said, "Who are you to say that?" I said, "I'm the chairman." So he said, "How long have you been that?" I said, "One day. Now fuck off."
Superb.
And he got escorted into the thing. If I'd been really cruel, I'd have put him in the middle of the Leicester crowd. But apparently, I don't know what they did with him. He wasn't that interested in football anyway, so he probably went home to Essex.
But if that followed on from Dennis Wise being one of the greatest cash flow savings at the time, wasn't it?
Yeah. Well, fortunately, he went and following a pre-season do, he attacked Callum Davidson in bed after he lost at cards to him. Callum Davidson, who was heavily, he's another one who didn't have great eyesight, actually. We seemed to specialise in signing them at that point. he wore contact lenses though and was slightly better than Akinbai, who didn't drive because he couldn't pass the eyesight driving test. As a result, we were able to sack Dennis Wise without compensation.
Yeah, he was basically the nice Dennis Wise. He basically thumped Callum Davidson in the head while Davis was in bed, broke his jaw, put him out for 6 weeks. At the time, Dennis Wise was on £1 million a year and his contract just got ripped up. And it was the administrator who did that. It was before we came on. Yeah. But it represented money we didn't have to find. So it was a true cash flow saving. So, you know, thank you, Dennis. It's about the only thing we can thank you for.
Is that right? Because I mean, my memory might be a bit hazy, but I think there's been some misinformation over the years that one of the reasons we ended up in administration as well was because Eric Hall was owed money and he sort of wouldn't. Is that not true?
Not at all. They tried to get a claim saying that Wise hadn't had due process, which was completely farcical. You know, if that was on a Swedish pre-season tour, if it wasn't there and it happened here, Dennis Rice would have ended up being jailed. Yeah. That's as simple as it is.
Speaking of overseas tours and players ending up in jail, James, is there any sort of lines or anecdotes you can share with us from La Manga that we might not have heard?
How did I know you were going to bring this one up, Jack? Yeah, well, we obviously, you know, in the first season in the Premier League, we had this break in La Manga, and I was sitting at my desk and suddenly Tim Davis was on the phone and saying, "We've got problems, etc. I'm going out there." So he went out there, find out what it is. And then it came out, there was these three girls who were alleging that our players had misbehaved with them and everything. And so Tim said, "Can you sort of take control of looking into it?" And I said, "All right, okay." I said, "First thing is we're going to have to sit each player down and get the truth off them. And you have to tell them, they have to tell us the old legal phrase, the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth. And also tell them, if we find that they have subsequently lied in any respect, their contract will be ripped up, and that's likely to be the least of their problems." And they all did, and they all gave accounts. And to be fair to them, then of course these three girls were interviewed by the police, and we get their witness statements, but those are in Spanish. Now, rather fortuitously, in my group at work, I had a lovely girl who was a secondee from the Madrid office. And she wasn't that busy at the time. So I said to her, I said, look, could you possibly translate these for me? I said, if you see anything, read anything you don't like or upsets you, whatever, just give them straight back to me. But I said, if you do that, I'll buy you and your husband dinner. Anyway, she did it for me. I will say the Spanish obviously eat at very expensive restaurants because I nearly went broke over that dinner, the things you do for Leicester City. But I got all the statements. I've got the players, I've got the girl statements, and there was not a single crime committed by any of those Leicester players. In fact, the only crime that could have been committed was by one of the girls who assaulted Paul Dickoff by trying to rip off his bracelet. There was so much misidentification as well. Poor old James Scowcroft had been in his bedroom and he'd phoned his wife late at night, yet he was identified as one of the people who had to spend a night in the police cell. And eventually the hotel records showed that, you know, he was in his hotel room. But as I say, there was nothing criminal. It was a bizarre thing. My own theory, and I think it's better, and it won't surprise you, it was a complete news of the world setup. Funny enough, my in-laws at the time had a place in La Manga, and they knew a guy who's a world reporter who was never there other than in the summer, but suddenly he was there in La Manga. And there was other things. The girls, amazingly, the girls' rooms were on the same floor as our players. Now, you know, how did that happen? And, you know, there were things done that you would say were stupid, but not illegal or anything. You know, one player had something to explain to his wife. One probably had something to explain to his teammates, but they did nothing wrong. But of course it got to people, and poor old Mickey Adams, it really got to. He was there fending it all off. And, you know, I think that was the start of the end for Mickey. He was a really decent bloke. But after that, you know, he found the pressures a lot. And as we know, he ended up, he was a true resignation, I think, in November of that year. But it was, you know, it was not what it was portrayed at. The funniest one was, to tell you this one, so I normally just buy the Times. And anyway, the shop at the end of my road, Mrs. Patel ran it. And suddenly I was going in and buying all the tabloids and everything every day. And this was literally every day. And then suddenly she tapped me on the shoulder one morning and said, James, you just buy the Times, go and take the others over by the freezer, read them there, just put them back, and that'll be all right. And it was fantastic.
James has what you might call the innocent view of this. I'd heard about it probably the night before James did, in that Paul Mace rang me and said, I'd ceased to be a director at this point, but the Jim McCahill had disappeared. We never knew where he went. He didn't emerge till the whole thing was over. He rang me up and said, we're in trouble. The players are in La Manga. I said, what are they doing out there? And he said, oh, well, Mickey decided to give them a break, because we'd had a previous incident in La Manga when Martin O'Neill, in probably one of the worst mistakes of his career, put John Robertson in charge of who can run a piss up in a brewery, in charge of and Stan Collymore let off a fire extinguisher and God knows what. I mean, the choice of La Manga as a place to go was pretty stupid. We were bottom of the league. Not massive disenchantment, but the players weren't, you know, if you're bottom of the league, send them off on a jolly. You may do that, but it shouldn't be a jolly. It should be serious.
We beat Birmingham 1-0 after going to La Manga. You can't do that.
And I'll tell you why we did that. I found out from Paul Mace. Greg Clark was around. He was in the country. He'd sadly left after, you know, setting up this deal. He left to work in Australia, but he was around that week. Tim Davis said, oh, they're all innocent. They're all innocent. I said, nobody is up at 2 a.m. messing about with brass is innocent in this case. It will look terrible, which it did, and the fans will not like it, which they didn't. And Tim said, oh, we'll stay out here and get it sorted. I said, no, you won't. You'll get them on the first plane home and we'll get an apology from the players for them behaving as they did, which is, you can't do, you can't behave like that. And Mickey rang me up. He was obviously disconsolate about the whole thing. I said, what were you doing letting them out at 2 a.m? He said, I trusted them. Well, you know, 20-year-old men who've got wads of cash in their pockets on a jolly in Spain with each other, they're not going to behave terribly well unless you give them really set rules. So the players did come back. The next bit was the manager, Tim Davies, said, no one's going to apologise. So I said, right, get me Dave Bassett on the phone, who's the director of football by this point. Dave was no nonsense. I like Dave, and he was a good director of football. Dave came on the phone and said, what do you think, John? What do you think? So I said, right, I'll tell you what I think. Unless you get one of the players to apologise within an hour, I'm taking my money out, and I'll get a load of other people out, and you'll be all out of a job and bottom of the division. And within an hour, he got Les Ferdinand to apologise. And yes, they did win on the Saturday, which was a reaction and was good, but we weren't good enough to stay up. The defence was not quite good enough, I'm afraid.
I have to say, I always thought it was down to John Curtis. It was obviously Wolves away, Middlesbrough away, and Tottenham at home. The 8 points that would have saved us.
I feel like you could have given away Rick's, who are you now? John Curtis.
One of my questions to James and John was going to be, which one affected you more, the Wolves debacle or the Middlesbrough one? I completely forgot about Spurs, but yeah, that John Curtis.
Okay, I have a unique take on Wolves. Because when I said my in-laws, my mother-in-law was Rachel Hayo Flint, who was on the board at Wolves. So we were in the boardroom. At half time, she wouldn't speak to me. At full time, I wouldn't speak to her.
We got a point at Middlesbrough, actually, to be fair.
We
lost at Wolves. And I mean, that was a dreadful result. We were ahead, a bit like the beginning of this season, funny enough, in a lot of games.
Yeah.
And couldn't hold on to it because the defence wasn't good enough. Bit similar again to this season.
It was funny that, you know, the step up in the first two games, I saw it, because, you know, Southampton at home, we went 2-0 up, brilliant Les Ferdinand header, if you remember. But then Kevin Phillips came with that 35-yard rocket, and it was just, he thought, the quality of that. And then at Chelsea, we went, James Scowcroft put us 1-0, and we gave away this free kick, and then Mutu took it, and he took it with his right foot, hit the wall, came back to it, he followed it straight in with his left. And I thought, crikey, what a standard.
John, bringing it back to kind of where we're at right now, I want to get your take on the current ownership and also the current manager as well, Brendan Rodgers. But we'll start with the ownership, of course. I mean, it's obviously something you're probably best placed to speak about. Well, what have you made of their tenure overall?
Well, we're very fortunate, aren't we, to have... I confess, we knew nothing about them in the first place. I was a bit worried since they seemed incredibly naive. They had one or two people at the club who I would deem dodgy. Terry Robinson got a bad write-up from people within the game that I trusted. And David Richards, who got a bad write-up from everyone. I think Susan Whelan was obviously a very good appointment. She didn't know anything about the game when she came in. She'll admit that. But she's very smart. And she, in fact, stabilised it from that point of view. And then one of the best things, obviously the best thing that Mandrake did, was he made the appointment of Nigel Pearson. I was not actually at that point very... very keen on. I thought we maybe could have done better. But he appointed Nigel Pearson. Then actually in an attempt to sell it, he sacked Nigel Pearson, bizarrely, and bought in Ericsson, as he thought that would appeal to the ties as being... He bought in Sousa as someone who he thought would sell the club better to a foreign owner, who's been a reasonably successful abroad as a manager. But he was a nice bloke, but he wasn't Nigel. Nigel should never have been dismissed at that point. We struggled a bit. Sousa didn't last very long. We bought in Ericsson, who to start with spent money like water. He'd never impressed me as a manager in the Premier League, really. One of these characters, there was a bit of myth about him. He'd done well in Italy in his early career and Monaco, but he never did much good in England, really. Unfortunately, then, through the efforts of Alan Birchinell, we got Nigel Pearson and his team. His team were critical. He had Steve Walsh, who was possibly one of the best recruiters we've ever had, and Craig Shakespeare was a good coach. They got on well together. They worked really well as a team in terms of recruiting people. They made some fabulous signings, if you think about it. You know, they recruited Vardy for £1 million. They recruited Mark Albrighton for nothing. They recruited Fuchs for nothing. They recruited Kante for about £4 million. They recruited Huth. They made some terrific Mahrez, who Steve Walsh went to watch and was told to watch somebody else, but thought, no, this player's the right player. So they made some fabulous signings. They worked in harmony, and it all went, as we know, really well. Terry Robinson, Susan had the nous to get rid of him, or persuade Vichai to get rid of him. David Richards went soon afterwards. The form picked up from there. And of course, you know, the Great Escape and whatever they did, it was an amazing story. It was something I never thought I would see in my lifetime.
No, of course not. I mean, you've obviously then seen lots of managers come and go as well during that time. I'm curious, John, if you had been on the board of directors or the chairman at the time, what would you have done with Brendan Rodgers this season? Would he still be in employment?
I'd have kept him, yeah, of course.
Yeah?
No,
yeah.
I mean, he is, on paper and in terms of trophies, as successful as anyone we've ever had. Mm. If you think about it, I mean, look at what's going on at the bottom. I mean, Southampton sacked one person. They want to appoint Jesse March. Why on earth would you want to appoint someone who's got Leeds in a mess? And Everton, who've gone through all sorts of managerial changes, bring Sean Dyche from Frank Lampard. Talk about change of style. Crikey. Then you get assistants who do well for a couple of games. Some freak results yesterday. I mean, Bournemouth, who've done really very little under Gary O'Neill, get a result, and Southampton do. So it's still tight. Potter, who everybody said, and if Brendan would have gone, most people said, oh, we'll get Graham Potter. Well, it's very interesting, isn't it? He's hardly won a game since he's gone to Chelsea, and Fofana has gone there, and I mean, he's not had a decent game for Chelsea. He's been injured, but he's not had a decent game.
I've got final question, but I can leave it to the end. I'm just fascinated to ask John one final thing. It's nothing to do with the current subject.
Go on, Rick. Just because I'm conscious, James hasn't got a word in edgeways yet.
I'm used to that with your father, Jack.
I was just going to ask, what would you have done, James, as Mr. Positivity?
What now?
Would you have sacked Brendan?
No, I'm exactly in the same place. No, I think he is a good manager. I don't quite know what went on over the summer because, well, obviously not enough went on. If I was with him now, I'd just say, Brendan, at some points during the last few months, you've talked more of yourself and the club have been separate entities, and you know we're in this together and everything. And what I really hope now is, but he remembers Top's loyalty to him. We know he's very well paid. I think all of us here know pretty much exactly what he's paid. So he's set up for life. We can safely say that. At that point, you know, Top has been very good to you. You now be good to Top.
Well, I think he has been because he could have gone previously. And to be honest, I don't blame football managers. In the current circumstances, they have to look after themselves. It's very rare that when there's a bad run, the chief executive or the owner comes out. It's always the manager. It's always the manager straight after the game. I never spoke to Mickey Adams straight after a game because, to be honest, they're too emotional and it's very difficult. And he has to look after himself. There is no doubt that a lot of people would have. And if you talk to people from other clubs, they would love to have him as manager.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
I mean, listen, would you sack Jurgen Klopp? Would you sack Graham Potter at the moment? There'll be a lot at those clubs. I mean, people wanted to sack Arteta the beginning of last season. Sometimes you have to decide. I mean, I don't think James would have ever sacked anyone as manager.
I was party to sacking Craig Levein, thank you very much.
curiously enough, I felt that Craig Levein...
I think you were also party to appointing him, James, to be fair.
I was hands up on both counts, yes.
I think the problem with Craig Levein is, as I've said, Craig Levein had undoubtedly got a good record. Yeah. In Scotland when he came. He never managed in England. And Dave Bassett had been given the impression by Tim Davies that he was going to get the job, which Tim Davies was in no position to do that. And he shouldn't have done that. In consequence, Dave Bassett stomped off. So you'd got Craig Levein left without any experience from the English game. Other than Rob Kelly, nice bloke, probably not strong enough, probably not ruthless enough, no director of football. And he brought down players from Scotland. And we all know, if you bring players down from Scotland, you've got to be very, very sure. He brought down some players who looked good in Scotland, but boy, did they look rubbish. There was a winger came, he was about 2 foot tall, Hamill. Great, he couldn't even touch
him. We had him on Who Are You the other week.
Yeah. We all remembered him, obviously.
Yeah.
I always thought Craig Levein looked like a real, obviously, budget Scottish version of Clark Kent, didn't he? Oh, Superman with the glasses. And...
yes.
And to be honest, he was about as good as him in the end, but without any superpowers.
But he was unbelievably arrogant. And I remember towards the end, you know, we'd lost 7 on the trot. And I said, look, something has to change, Craig, and you have the first chance to change it. But, you know, you have to do it. And I sat there with Rob Kelly, and then, you know, Rob eventually took over. And Rob is a very decent bloke, and, you know, and he saved us from going down, which was the great thing. Because one of the things, when you're on the board, you know, at that time, the proudest record we had is we'd never be below the top two divisions. And I just couldn't countenance myself being on the board with us going down. I had sleepless nights about it, you know, because it was looking iffy at points. But we turned around. And by the way, somebody we mentioned previously, Martin George, when Rob was there and it was looking dicey, Martin, he's a funny fish, but he knows football. And I just talked to him religiously. He used to go down the training ground. And they probably didn't like seeing him all the time. But when he came back to me and he said, James, he said, he has the players. We're going to be safe. The players are with him, and it was critical. And Martin knew this, I listened to Martin. I listened to John as well. You don't have any choice but to listen to John. But yeah, I actually sort out Martin on this, and he was a great help. And he really, really does know football. Over the years, Leicester City's owed Martin George a lot.
Can I ask John one final question then?
Yes, mate.
Before I let let these busy men get on with their Sundays. So, John. I mean, Gary Lineker is my all-time hero. And obviously, when I found out that with Jack and you, I was like, oh, brilliant. The only reason why I'm on the podcast, I could ask. But
you want some crisps?
Well, no. But before the 1990 World Cup, I did not like football. I was like 6 or 7. Only thing I used to like back then were them horrible little hamsters, them Sylvanian families. But I got into football, and my question is, was there ever even an inkling that Gary could have come back for a swan song season? I know we were a bit, you know, we didn't have them. No, nothing. Nothing. What, even after Grandpa's 8? when he was...
Well, he never played again after Grampus. No. His toe had gone. We were pretty sure when he went to Japan that he had said to me, I'm not sure. I certainly can't play for England. And I'm going to be struggling Premier League. He got a bad injury. The surgeon in London did the wrong operation on his toe. And he actually virtually never played in Japan. And there was no doubt. We knew from about, probably 6 months before he finished, they kept doing operations and so on. But we knew it was up, and we were planning the career in broadcasting at that point.
I did get to see him in a testimonial. He put a shirt on back in
that was caused us a bit of problem, that, because he'd sworn blind he wouldn't play again, and then Gordon tried to persuade him and so on and so on, and he's not played a lot of cricket since then, because he used to be wicket keeper back, but he struggles to take off. Your big toe is your taking off impulse, and it's on his right foot.
I bet he not get around the snooker table very swiftly either, will he, with a big toe?
He could get around that. He played a lot of golf. He was a good golfer.
Yeah, he's a very good golfer. Yeah, he is.
But Gary has, with games, I don't think he's played snooker for yonks, and he gave up golf a few years ago. He has a sort of, I know what he means, because I'm nowhere near, I'm not even within a breath of being that level of sportsman, but I understand with people who get to a certain level and then say, I'm not going to get any better, I'm going to do the next thing.
He said,
"Is that why you gave up golf, Dad?"
Sorry,
is that why you gave up golf?
Yeah,
still waiting for the next thing.
Well, Lineker said his best break was 135 on Twitter last week. I'll be going down the club later to play a few shots, and my best break's about 23.
So. He was a seriously good player. He was a seriously good cricketer as well. I mean, I can remember talking to him when he was quite young, because I always talked to the players about what they were going to do when they finished off. And I can remember saying to him, what would you have done if you hadn't been a footballer? And he said, I'd have been a cricketer, which I thought was quite quick. So I said, okay, smart ass, what if I've broken both your legs? And he said, I'd have liked to be a sports journalist, but I can't do that. And I said, why do you think you couldn't do that? He said, because I'm not trained. I said, listen, I was a journalist once. I'll tell you, the only training you get is how to fiddle your expenses. That's it. Ask any journalist of the era I grew up in, that was it.
Brilliant.
Right, have we got any more, lads? No, are we all done?
No, we're all good.
Well, just then, one last one from me for both of you, really. Obviously, you know, both Leicester fans and still go to this day every week to watch the football club. I mean, listen to you both talk about the club and your time there. It's nice, isn't it, doing nostalgia stuff. Did you enjoy it at the time, or do you enjoy it more now talking about the old times?
Do you mean when sort of we're on the board or... When
Mandrich threw you out of the ground?
Oh, yes, I was banned by Mandrich. I made a reference one night to the totalitarian regime, and he didn't seem to like it. but it was quite an easy fix, because I just walked around the other side of the ground and got in. But it was all right. I found the book, I have to say, it was nothing being a fan. Being on the board just added to the pressures, and as I said, I had sleepless nights about us looking like we're going to be relegated to what is truly Division 3. I didn't like that at all. You know, the responsibility weighs on you. We're never being there. I'm much enjoying the fact. Anyway, we've just had the most unbelievable time recently. But I loved the old days. I loved it. You couldn't enjoy this without having the bit that went before. It all builds up. We've all got our own histories with it. And it is. And it's so, yeah, I would have said, I'm not queuing up to go on the board again. Let's put it that way.
it's a horrible job, actually. It spoils your enjoyment. Yeah. It was always, you know, my great pastime. It's, you know, it's always been part of my life since I was 7 years old. So 65 years, you know, three cup finals in the 1960s when we were pretty good side in those days. And then in the 70s, we were not a bad side for a spell under Bloomfield. And then we had the O'Neill years and we won the League Cup twice, crikey. And I thought that was fantastic. And I thought that was about as far as we're going to get. And then the second of those occasions, there were three generations of my family. My father was still alive then, and Jack and I sat together, and Gary and his father, and one or two of his boys. Can you remember, Jack? Was it?
Yeah, I think.
All sat together, and you know that was a great moment.
Harry and Tobias went. I think. Yeah.
Well, yeah. So it was, you know, it's been part of my life all the way through. It was nice to be able to make sure that the club didn't go out of business. Mm. And obviously you think back and say, did anything we did help what happened later come? Well, absolutely not directly. But I think it kept us alive at that point. And had we not been kept alive and had to be reconstructed in a lower division or whatever, then I don't think the ties had come in, and so that wouldn't have happened. So you take some sort of pleasure from that. Did I enjoy doing the job? No, not really. No, it's a rotten job because the manager always wants at least two new players. That's a constant. The people in the boxes want better sausages or something. The fans all want you to they're shouting, get your money out. I mean, if I got my money out, it'd buy somebody's little finger for half an hour, you know. It's nonsense.
One of the funniest things of being around the boardroom, you know, you analyse the team's performance, and the boardroom discussion was exactly the same discussion as I would have with my mates down the pub. There's no great insight.
Well, look, we're all incredibly grateful anyway that you guys did step up and do what you did back then. And of course, also massively grateful that you've given them the time this evening to share all them stories. I know that, I mean, I speak for myself and the lads, we've really, really enjoyed that. I'm sure that the listeners have done as well. So, yeah, it's very, very much appreciated, guys. Thank you very much.
Bill's in the post. See ya.
Yes. Cheers. Anyway, cheers, John. Take care. Cheers. Bye-bye.
Thank you, James. Thank you very much.
Superb. Superb.
That was brilliant. Yeah, absolutely brilliant.
Even if it's 2 a.m. in Australia for Jack.
Even if it's 2 a.m. in Australia, and I've heard all those stories before.
Yeah. Well, I was about to say,
well, I'm glad you boys enjoyed it.
Because yeah. you've got back 5 or so hours before you're going to have to catch a flight as well, aren't you? Back to the UK.
No, I've got a bit more than that. I've got a little bit more than that. 11 a.m. UK time. So I'll get a few hours, Kip. Don't worry. It's all right. I'm readjusting to UK time.
You can't put price on that. You'll download the podcast for the flight home and listen to it all again.
I know, yeah. Yeah, chuckle my way home, yeah.
Because, I mean, look, that has gone on a little bit longer than anticipated, but also at the same time, I'm sure you can appreciate why we allowed that to continue, and we all still had loads more questions. And we still have got other bits to talk about on this episode.
You've left the play today.
Yeah, exactly. That's the point. You know, we've got other games. Exactly. Jack, bear in mind, it is, what, 1:45 there in Australia. Do you want to stay with us for the rest of the episode, or do you want to bow out?
I'll play Who Are You? Because I just don't want to lose my winning record. But apart from that, I'm not fussed.
This one's unreal, honest. This one's gold.
I don't want to completely ruin the flow, Jake.
No, not at all. Come on, let's get this done then. Let's play Who Are You.
Come on, then.
Who is your daddy and what does he do?
Who are you?
You.
No, not me, you.
Yes, I am you.
Just answer the damn questions. Who are you?
Wait a minute. Who are you?
Yes, let's play Who Are You. It's not going to be John Curtis because we've already had that one. And I love that as well, Jack, your dad mentioning Joe Hamill. the name one could get just a few weeks ago on the podcast. Well,
I don't think he remembered his name. He was just a small Scottish winger, wasn't he?
Yeah, but it was one of them at the time we mentioned, didn't we, that it was that era we had so many players, and even the chairman can't remember half the ones we had at the time. But anyway, Rick, you're in charge today, correct?
Yes, I am. Yeah, it's late realisation, but not a problem. Easy this one. Beautiful. For me. Right winger.
You had straight in with the position?
Yeah, straight in. Yeah.
Oh, wow.
I'm only going to bother with right wingers. If I ever do it, it's right wingers.
Right,
Mo Salah?
Nope.
Ben Marshall.
No.
This is the most bizarre game.
Nicky Summerby.
No.
Keith Gillespie.
No. You've only given us a year.
Who is James your daddy Bancroft. And what does he do? No.
Right, can I have more than a right winger, please?
Yeah, right. Okay, so he was born on the 15th of January, 1976, in Oldham. And his first club... No. He's 47. His first club was Hibernian in Scotland.
The same
David
age
Bell.
As, nope.
Same age as Darren Eady.
From last year. Glory years.
We played against David Bell a few years ago, Jack.
Did you? Did you win?
Yeah, we beat him. I think we beat him 3-0, and he was like pumped up, like it's in like muscle.
He's been on the
tattoos all over him.
Jacked.
On the winstrel. Mm.
He played briefly for Kings Lynn as well at the end of his career when I was doing local radio back there. And it was one of them where I think he was only about 30 at the time, but obviously decided, you know, professional football couldn't really be bothered too much, but he was still just like levels and levels above, even though when he wasn't trying.
It's not him.
Carry on, sorry.
Not
an anecdote time.
Just second trying to keep clue. Jack awake.
Yeah, sorry.
Yeah, okay, so second clue, and this is where it really piqued my interest. So he came to us on loan in 2004-2005.
Spurs scored.
Great.
Okay.
Sorry, Rick.
That's all right. He got an assist on his debut for us.
Is it Kelvin Atuhu?
No. Right. 2004-2005. That's a bit. Atuhu was a year or two after that.
I'm rubbish of the years unless you tell me what happened in that season.
Okay. So that year was post Levine. It was post.
Don't give him a clue.
This is literally his job to give us clues.
Right.
We can't ask for more clues.
Wait. So he got an assist on his debut for us, but he only made two appearances for us on loan. Then, as luck would have it, we released him from his loan early. He joined a different club, Stoke, right? And on his home debut against us, he got a hat-trick of assists.
Oh, wow. Right.
And he's a right winger.
Were we away at Stoke?
Yeah, it was his home debut, so yeah.
Was it Mark Yeats?
No, but good one.
Was it like early in the season? Like
he's older
first
than
game?
That.
No, so he was on loan to us at the first part of the season. He didn't do a lot.
Three games.
He played two games for us.
Got an
assist on his debut.
And he got three assists against us on his home debut for Stoke.
Yeah.
This is a great one. I love this, Rick.
It's not Sean Newton. No, it can't be Sean Newton because we signed him.
He's a right winger. And okay, do you want another clue?
Yeah, I think I'm going to be really close. I think one more.
We got him on loan, and this is where he made his name, from Portsmouth. And actually, when he left us to go back to Portsmouth, then Stoke signed him permanently.
And this is going to be one of those. Stoke, it's like,
Portsmouth, Hibs, Leicester.
Made his name at Portsmouth.
Final clue. Okay. Well, not a final clue, because if you don't get it, I'm going to be left here.
You're enjoying this far too much. The authority in your voice.
You've just got to love right wingers like I do. So he was the first, right? I'm going down to managerial. No, hang on. Where am I going here? Managerial statistics. Here we go. Okay, are you ready for it?
Mm.
I've lost me bit. Where are we going?
Right.
He's the first. He's the first black, Asian, or minority manager in Scotland since 2003, who was Marcio Maximo.
Kevin Harper.
Yes.
Oh, that's a great one.
Ghosted it again.
Well played, Jack. That's a really good one. Good one from you as well, Rick.
Thank you.
Good clues as well.
I'm not sure he was a right winger. I think he was a centre mid, wasn't he?
Yeah, I thought he was just a midfielder.
Right winger. The thing is, back then, he was right midfield, wasn't he?
He could play anywhere.
He was not Tete, was he? He was workmanlike. He was Josh Lowe.
Yeah.
Ilk.
Josh
Lowe would be a good one, wouldn't he? He was terrible.
I'll spoil next week.
I think we've guessed Josh Lowe before, and it wasn't him.
Yeah. I think we've literally just listed the entirety of the right wingers that played for the club in about a 10-year spell. So I don't think there are any right wingers in that era left.
Oh, I bet you there's more.
Gabor Bory, the Hungarian.
Yeah. Yeah, but that's obvious because he was on loan, Hungarian. You get that really quickly.
It's one of two, isn't it?
Two for one, wouldn't it?
Yeah.
Oh, dear. I mean, what do we want to do at this stage? I'm going to mention this, actually. So in the week, I put on social media that this season, so this being our debut season on the podcast, we'd surpassed 10,000 downloads. And so first of all, I want to say thank you for that. I think that is a lot more and a lot quicker getting to that number than we probably would have ever anticipated. So really do appreciate that. And loads of really nice comments. But one of them, what made me laugh was the fact that he likes how unplanned each episode appears to be, which I took almost a little bit of offence to. But also at the same time, he's probably bang on, isn't it? We know what we're talking about. And then we just kind of just go with it. And we're going to do kind of the live production meeting once again at this point and say, what do we want to do next? Jack, do you want to stay with us? Do we want to bother talking about the next game? Do you want to go back to Manchester United? What do we want to do, lads? Yeah. Nothing. Sit in silence.
Directed at Jack, isn't it?
Any one of you three, really. That's a bit
unfair. I'm done with Man United. What's the point?
I would say, there's no plan before, but after a few beers on a match day, there's even less of a plan. Any, comment on individual performances, don't like to single people out, but there was a few comments in the WhatsApp group about certain players.
Kelechi Iheanacho was really, really average today.
But I'm going to go back to what Rick said last week. Rick, can you remember what you said about him? We need to allow him if he does play badly.
Yes.
To have that run. We've staunchly stood by Harvey Barnes if he's had three or four bad games. We've staunchly stood by the manager. If he doesn't do well. Iheanacho was crap today when everyone was crap. Very few were not crap. So I think it is unfair to dig him out. I'm not saying he played well because obviously he didn't. They're all okay for 20 minutes.
Yeah.
I don't think he was very good, but I do agree with you. I was maybe slightly harsh last week. I hadn't had much sleep. Actually, the Barnes comparison is quite a good one because I think someone wrote on Twitter that he's an output machine, and yeah, he kind of is actually. So maybe. We do need to stick. Evening.
It was quite interesting that they didn't bring Dakar on either, did they? So he's trying to stick with Iheanacho for as long as possible. I know Vardy came on, but he's trying to. I think he's giving.
And did you see rumours during the week as well of a move to Galatasaray as well for Dakar, with the Turkish window being different to this one? I'm not sure if that has now passed and whether there was that much truth in it or
they'd
not.
They'd offer us 90p
I kind of alluded to it last week that I do get the impression that Rodgers has decided that Dak is not going to be the one. And it will be Iheanacho with Vardy to come off the bench, and then they'll probably recruit someone in the summer. And I do think Dakar will be off, whether you think right or wrong, the fact that he hasn't featured at all again the last few games.
A few games.
But today you would have thought that Dakar would have come on.
Today all the players had lost their heads and bringing on some experience, it was probably the right thing to do. So, I mean, in previous games, he's brought Vardy on, probably seeing out the game. So I don't know. I would like to think that he'll give Dakar another crack of the whip. I've had a look at some of his stats this week. He's still right up there despite not playing that well. So you know, I think he's worth another go. And, you know, Vardy's probably going to have one more year next year. Kel will probably be the main man now. Like, I would keep Daka around and see, because I think there is a player there, but I keep saying it. So yeah. Speaking of players that I've backed, Sumaré was bang average today, wasn't he? Wow.
I didn't realise he was on for quite a while. And then
you could hear on the cameras they were going, Booba, run! And he's not running.
I mean, yeah, but I think everyone's head went, didn't they, unfortunately? Yeah. I think you can come away with saying anyone's played particularly well or bad. You know, I think we've said it all, haven't we, really?
I think today was just a bit of a write-off in terms of the red, the second goal. And, you know, look, the three games before, we took 7 points. We all said, and I think every Leicester fan would agree, it's a free hit. Go there, see what happens. Yeah. First half an hour, we were absolutely fantastic. And if we get a lead in the game, it's a completely different game. So I know Jack likes his stats. I saw this one the other day and I couldn't believe what I was hearing. An expected assist, whatever that means. Does that mean your strikers are shit? But Ian Acho should have had an expected assist for Barnes when De Gea made a save to his left.
So Barnes should have scored that.
It's a good save,
but Barnes should not give him the opportunity to make the save.
It looked to me like Barnes didn't have any backlift on it. I thought he was just going to pass it into the corner and open himself up like he normally does, but he didn't really get any purchase on the shot. It was still a good save. But for me, like the main thing is, I mean, I watched Everton yesterday, Everton Leeds. I know it was 3 o'clock kickoff, so I'm not going to admit to how. I've watched Villa. I mean, match of the day, you can't really tell, but Forest looked fucking terrible again and somehow got away with a point.
Yeah, they got battered. I saw that one. I don't know how they got a point.
Wolves lost at home to Bournemouth. Southampton somehow got a win, well, because of one man again. But if you look at that first half an hour, I know I've said it all season, but there's absolutely nothing to worry about in terms of relegation for me, because we are on that first half, our first half performance, that side is very, very good.
I'm not worried, but I'm massively frustrated by the fact that everyone else has won this weekend down there, and similar happened a week ago as well. You know, we've still got games against Arsenal and Chelsea, and obviously Chelsea is a slightly different prospect at the moment, but regardless, we've got Arsenal and Chelsea coming up, so they're not necessarily the games you would hand pick, are they? So I mean, with Arsenal itself, the next one, I mean, I saw the game against Villa at the weekend, and you know, they did win 4-2, but I thought they were very lucky, you know, and it was two very, very late goals, wasn't it? And the Jorginho one, which goes off the back of Martinez's head, and then
it was quite funny that Martinez was
I loved it
look like an absolute penis.
I've got a bit of a weird shout. So, being a father of two young children, I don't know whether anyone's ever watched Frozen, right?
I'm familiar, but no.
Emi Martinez, have a look. You won't be able to not see it. He looks like Olaf, the snowman from Frozen. Have a look. Honestly, especially when he's holding that trophy after he's got the golden glove.
Yeah. Anyway, yeah, look.
There you go. Have a look.
Right. I think we're at the end, aren't we, lads? Have we got anything else we want to talk about? No? I think Jack's done, for sure. We need to let Jack go, get some sleep. And obviously next week's episode, you're going to be back here in the UK, which will be a novelty and such. Yeah, you're not going to be absolutely exhausted. And I know that I mentioned the back end of last week's pod about Laura Woods. Of course, obviously, we decided to speak to John and James today. And I hope you did enjoy that. I'm sure you absolutely did. So look, we'll look to get Laura on next week's, because as well, she was in the States last week for the Super Bowl anyway. So would have been unavailable to come on this week. Lads, we'll leave it there. Jack, please pass on the message to Father Holmes.
Will do.
Honestly, was brilliant. I know the lads, Rick and Jordan, felt the same. It was incredibly interesting to hear so many of those stories of, you know, La Manga and just the inner workings of a football club. I know you've heard them stories a million times beforehand, but it was great, and I'm sure everyone appreciated it. So yeah, do pass on the thanks. So yeah, next week we'll be back as we look back at the game against Arsenal. So enjoy your week and we'll speak to you then.
Social Podcast Network.